are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, March 26, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, managing director of TalkPoverty.com, Pat Garofalo, on the billionaire boondoggle. How our politicians let corporations and bigwigs steal our money and our jobs. Also on the program today, Trump administration seeking again to repeal the ACA, this time through the courts. Meanwhile, House and Senate Dems demand full Mueller report. McConnell blocks in the Senate. And the House will try to override Trump's veto on the emergency wall powers bill. Republicans will stop them there. 1.3 million Puerto Rican residents will have their food stamps cut this month, amongst other austerity measures. Pentagon hiding Google's work on drones. Stephen Moore set to destroy our economy. Bank drops a money laundering suit against Felix Sater. And Obama on the case tells freshman Dems Green New Deal too expensive. Sorry, world.
Thanks, Obama.
All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Tuesday. Michael is at a dentist appointment. Everyone else is here. Just a reminder, you can support this show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Pennies a day. You can support this program. We give you extra content every day. Stephen Moore. I want to get into this. And I will mention that, like, that Felix Sater thing. Just because I think people know that's my pet. Theory about that Felix Sater plays a big role, largely in part just because two and some odd years ago, Wayne Barrett just kept telling me over and over again, it's all Felix Sater. With the Mueller report having dropped, maybe we will see it. I suspect we will see at least parts of it. Don't know how much.
He sounds like a white-collar criminal.
Felix Sater?
Oh, yeah.
Well, what we do know about Felix Sater is seems to be some type of FBI-CIA asset to the extent that Loretta Lynch, former attorney general, but when she was back at the Eastern District of the U.S. Attorney's Office, wrote an affidavit on his behalf after he stabbed a guy in the face with a broken glass.
Wow. Damn.
Which is a weird thing for someone to do. But apparently he's been an asset to the FBI. Supposedly there's reporting that he was the guy who got the CIA bin Laden's phone number, which is in the way that they tracked him. And there's this lawsuit that basically claims he ran off with I guess it was a mayor's family in Kazakh, with $400 some odd million that he was going to launder. This is what the lawsuit alleges. He was going to launder through the Trump Tower in Moscow, as well as other places around the world, and also coming back to Trump Soho Tower. So this guy was a money launderer and a special advisor to Donald Trump. And
he sounds like the antagonist from a Bond movie.
Yeah, exactly.
To be perfectly honest, without even knowing any of that stuff you just said.
Well, he's. I think he was a stoolie. He was an asset, and he was probably run out of the New York FBI office. So, I don't know. You start to get obviously. I mean, nothing I've said is speculative. It's all been reported. There is a lawsuit. There is an affidavit that Loretta Lynch put in there. What the meaning of it is, I don't know. But
intrigue.
There is some intrigue here. And it suggests, the genesis of the investigation that Mueller ultimately took over from Comey after Comey was fired by the president. The president said, I fired him because he was investigating me. I mean, that's, there's no doubt that
we can see our way to look past this.
Right. I mean, look, there's no doubt that there were people who used this investigation for their own purposes, ranging from, people who wanted to be on TV quite a bit. And, people who thought that maybe it would help them electorally. We know the Democrats didn't run on that particularly, but, on some level, it's in the background. I think it was used at times that when it looked like Donald Trump was in serious legal jeopardy, that it may have made some legislators more hesitant Republicans to push certain things. But in terms, and certainly there were people who have, I think, who used it for, to inflate their podcast numbers or to promote a foreign policy. I mean, that's what happens in politics. People use different things that are happening. But as far as the genesis of it, you have a campaign where they bring on a guy who's been monitored by spy services, Carter Page, who I met and I think is just a raving lunatic. And I'm not sure, I would trust him to lead me out of a building with two sets of stairs, frankly. But this is a guy that they had been monitoring because of his behavior. And then he joins the Trump campaign. There are other connections. I don't know to what extent. You see Felix Sater, and if you know he's an asset at that time, well, then it makes a lot of sense. If you don't know he's an asset, then you start to wonder, why is all this money coming into these Trump towers? Why are all these meetings? I happen to think Donald Trump did not think he was going to win. And in those situations, you promise people stuff if you think it's going to help your relationship. That's called business, right? I mean,
called making deals.
Yeah. Hey, Brendan, I may get a TV show. So why don't you hang out here and put in a couple of extra hours? And when I get that TV show, you're going to be a producer. I don't think I'm going to get the TV show, but Brendan comes in and puts in extra hours. And all of a sudden I get the TV show and oh, damn it. I've got to let Brendan work on the show now. I screwed up. But I'm not convinced that wasn't the nature of it. But from the perspective of investigators who are looking into this in the summer of 2015 or 2016, and then the president fires the lead investigator and announces I needed to get him off, basically, I didn't like the fact that he was investigating me. I'm not sure what people are supposed to do at that point. Did other people run with it? Absolutely. And I think people have to be held to account with how far they got out in front of this story. But the story was real. The investigation did exactly what it should do. And in the meantime, it also found a lot of malfeasance by a lot of different players, which has been going on. And I don't think that excuses it, though. I think we should be rounding up more of them. And I don't, whether it's whatever firms were doing crap like this. I don't know why they weren't rounded up in the first place. I do know why they weren't. So I don't, you know, I have no idea what's in the report at this point. I don't know that we have an accurate reflection from William Barr, who, you know, but I imagine we're going to see parts of the report. I don't know that I should believe William Barr's assessment that, in fact, Russia interfered in the election. But, you know, like I said from day one, of course they did. It would be malfeasance for them not to. We do it. I mean, how could we not be doing this? That's right. What's done. And there is a fundamental problem with the country that, you know, allows for that level of interference to even be considered to have any implications on the outcome of an election. There were, you know, 20 different things that I think had gone a different way. The outcome would have been different. But yes, there's an underlying problem in the country that that it would be so close. And, you know, I'm not going to, we can have other conversations we've had, millions of them, as to what the underlying problems are. But that aside, you know, the idea that this was a hoax from the beginning is absurd. Yes, there are people who got out in front of where the investigation was. But to suggest that the whole thing should have been completely ignored. Like, I mean, I even think like the first Benghazi hearing probably was worthwhile. It was the eighth one that became, you know, somewhere along that spectrum where it became ridiculous, and to spend your time covering it would have been a joke. But to completely ignore this and to assume that it was initiated because of like these weird, these other sort of like narrow agendas. Like, and it may be the case that this was exploited to achieve other goals. Definitely. I mean, that's what happens all the time, right? I mean, it's
that explained my interest in it.
Well, I mean, it does all things people try to use in politics. People try to make a case from Donald Trump's win that we should have a different type of Democrat win. And we make those arguments or, you know, be the nominee. People look at, you know, I mean, this is the way that politics work. And you can, I think it's a perfectly legitimate criticism to make of the way that this was exploited. And I think we did a fairly decent job over the course of this to not, reward those who were, I think, transparently or even less transparently trying to use this investigation and get out in front of it in some way. Now, I happen to not think that any of this is resolved in any way. I think there's, you know, from the beginning, I think we were talking like most of this is going to come down to financial. I mean, I think we were saying that in, you know, on day one, literally, that it was just going to be stories about money laundering. But that was basically all based upon, you know, some discussions and an interview that we did on this program with Wayne Barrett, who has been following Donald Trump and this whole stuff for a long time. But I can understand why people in Washington might have been like, hey, we're investigating him in a fairly routine thing. And then he fires the head of the FBI. That's weird. It's a little bit weird. But yes, were there politicians and media figures who basically thought, like, I'm going to ride this? Yeah, of course. And, you know, they've got to dig themselves out of a hole. But hundreds of thousands of people did not die. Millions of people were not made internal and external refugees. We ended up not having World War III. If we haven't at this point, I don't think we're going to, at least as this is a foundation. I'm not saying there weren't bad things that came out of this, but certainly no worse than, you know, what's happening to people in Puerto Rico, for God's sakes.
There's no comparison.
Right. Exactly. The to the extent that there's been any damage done by this, it's that maybe we don't see as much about what's going on in Puerto Rico. But, you know, to the extent that we do know stuff about Puerto Rico, there's a decent crossover by, you know, like, you know, I don't, to the extent that I saw the most coverage of Puerto Rico, it mostly came on Hayes' show. And then, you know, Naomi Kant's going down there and, you know, the Democracy Now and stuff like this, but it's not like, Fox News was covering a lot of stuff that was going on in Puerto Rico.
They were doing white nationalism.
Yeah, Tucker Carlson was not featuring the plight of Puerto Ricans and their lack of electricity. So that is
the media is bad, folks. I think is the conclusion.
Yeah, and here's the thing. I think that is also
media.
Here's
we're
the thing
good,
that I think
though.
Is
we're
also
very good.
I think here's the thing. I mean, but we don't do any firsthand reporting, and everything that we do on this program is contingent upon there being reporters. And so make no mistake about that. We are not reporters. We are aggregators who assess and essentially curate and editorialize based upon reporting that exists. And anybody on YouTube who tells you they're reporting anything is full of garbage. And to the extent that we provide any service, it's, you know, we read it and we make assessments so that you don't have to, and over time you judge whether our assessments and what we present is relevant and at least, sound in some manner. And that's the way you should approach all of your media. And when you find that it's not, then you theoretically act accordingly.
Yeah, the amount of funding that it takes, the amount of overhead that it takes to go out there and do real reporting in the world is a lot. It's too much for a podcast, certainly, and it scares me that it's drying up.
Yes, it's very problematic. And I will add that the power of cable news is greatly diminished from where it was just even 10, 15 years ago, certainly 20 years ago. In the run-up to the Iraq War, if you looked on page 8 or 10 of the New York Times or the Washington Post, or maybe you saw reporting from McClatchy, you could see tells that this the run-up to the Iraq War was full of crap. But it was overwhelmed because there was no mechanism like there is today to amplify those stories, to push back. But social media, the growth of YouTube, which did not exist at that time, but basically social media, allowed for people who were, you know, smaller groups of people to amplify counter narratives. So it is true. There was a lot of people who anticipated Mueller to go in there, I guess, and arrest Donald Trump, even though we knew early on that you can't, that according to the DOJ, of which he is a part of as special counsel, you can't indict a sitting president. But there was a lot of motivated reasoning there. And that motivated reasoning was certainly not inhibited in any way by various commentators and newsreaders and cable news outlets. But the bottom line is that cable news does not have the same power it did then. And it did not lead to it did not lead, and I don't think there was ever a danger, it seems to me, of leading to, you know, people who speak Russian getting beat up in Coney Island, or and people make a decent argument that that news outlets, various news outlets were punished in the wake of this. But I will remind you, they were punished or, you know, singled out, deranked, or smeared in some way. Not because of the story that Donald Trump was colluding with the Russian government, but that the Russian government was interfering with the election, which it did.
They certainly according tried. According to this,
well, I mean, I don't know what, I don't know that it brought about a different result, but if you're going to believe William Barr, they did. And just like we should not be doing this with Venezuela or any other country, and I'm not shocked that they did, but they did. And so that becomes a pretext to punish different media outlets. I understand that sucks. When there was white nationals, you know, AT&T was ended up through YouTube advertising on Nazi sites. We got demonetized for months. It was scary. But at the end of the day, the investigation ran its course, found that there was no criminal charges that could be pursued. We're not going to know one third of this story by the end of it. I'm convinced of that. There's going to have been fuck ups. There's going to have been cover your ass situations. That's always the case with this. We always see the shadows. We see the reflections, the outlines. But I don't see how the government could have reacted, the apparatus could have reacted any differently. I mean, at any juncture. And Trump was obviously very worried about an investigation. And it turns out he was probably worried about it for a different reason. Because of other criminal activities he's been up to that were a lot more banal. But you start acting that way, you know, they think you might have a body in the trunk, and it turns out all you have is like 10 kilos of cocaine. But if you speed off as the cops coming after you, they're going to act as if they think, I mean, they thought that you might have a body in the car, and you drive down the road and you speed off, they're going to chase you. So, I mean, I think that's a lot of what we saw in this instance.
He's definitely guilty of something.
Well, I mean, we know, like, you know, that raises a whole nother set of questions as to, like, how is it that this guy got away with all this stuff in New York for so long when you have some very ambitious prosecutors? And that is a story I also don't know that we will.
I think they look to service their ambition elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, the question is why? And I think it's probably a different answer depending on who it is. I mean, like, we know why, let's say, a guy like Schneiderman, maybe, who maybe for reasons like he didn't feel comfortable going after Trump, because maybe there's a whole host of people he didn't feel comfortable going after because of aspects of his personal life that, you know. But
New York does have a long history of corruption.
Indeed.
Which, you know, brings up questions once again of the level of influence that money has in politics and oligarchs and all that stuff.
Indeed. All right. Well, we got to take a break. Before we do, folks, there's no need to suffer through another sleepless night, even if you're me, thanks to Calming Comfort by Sharper Image. The luxurious weighted blanket is made with super soft velveteen material and designed with high density comfort fill to promote a sense of calmness.
Should broadcast with it.
Yeah, no kidding. I should, actually. We should do that. Plus, by applying an even amount of pressure over your body, Calming Comfort helps the production of serotonin and melatonin and mimics the soothing feeling of being hugged for a restful night's sleep. I can tell you that, honestly, it is, it's made a world of difference for me. It's cut my sleeping time. I need it when Saul comes in and tells me he's peed his bed at like 5 in the morning. I've got, you know, an hour of sleep left. If I can get back to sleep in like 15, 20 minutes, which is very difficult for me to do. And the Calm and Comfort weighted blanket that that I have makes it a lot easier. It immediately just is like, oh. Calm and Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free, stress-free, best night's sleep of your life guarantee from the Sharper Image. Right now, our listeners can go to calmandcomfortblanket.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout to receive $15 off the displayed price. Again, that's calmandcomfortblanket.com, promo code MAJORITY, because you can't put a price on a great night's sleep. calmandcomfortblanket.com, promo code MAJORITY. Also, you should know, and you probably, well, maybe you don't know how often, but every 2 seconds, there's a new victim of identity theft, which means a criminal could be spending your money, applying for loans in your name, even damaging your credit, the good credit you've worked so hard to build. Unfortunately, you can miss certain threats to your identity by just checking bank statements and monitoring your credit. Good thing there's LifeLock Identity Theft Protection. LifeLock uses proprietary technology to detect and alert you to a wide range of identity threats, like your social security number for sale on the dark web. And if you have an issue involving identity theft, one of LifeLock's identity restoration specialists will work to fix it. Of course, no one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. But with LifeLock, you get identity theft protection and additional features to help protect your devices against cyber threats for as low as $9.99 a month. Don't waste another second. Visit LifeLock.com/majority now to save 10% on your first year. That's LifeLock.com/majority for 10% off. LifeLock.com/majority. Quick break, and we come back. Pat Garofalo on the billionaire boondoggle. How our politicians, like corporations and bigwigs, steal our money and jobs. Right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome the managing editor of Talk Poverty, the author of The Billionaire Boondoggle, How Our Politicians Let Corporations and Bigwigs Steal Our Money and Jobs, Pat Garofalo. Welcome back. Long time, I think, to the show.
Thank you so much. It has been a while.
It has. Now, look, I wasn't going to start with this, but I just saw a story that just, I don't know how I came across this, the American Dream, the Mega Mall in New Jersey, which I have been following through, I think this is the eighth name that they have given this thing. The opening, and this is going to come as a huge shock, is likely pushed back to the fall. Apparently... The mega mall in the Meadowlands was supposed to open, I guess, like any day now or something. But now it's coming in the fall of 2019. Let's start there, because you write about a dynamic that covers Amazon. It covers the building of sports arenas. It covers the retail enticements. It covers film and movie stuff, which is where I really wanted to start. But I had to start with the American Dream. Tell us the story of the American Dream, since you are a New Jerseyite yourself.
Yeah, one more sad trombone for the American Dream. I'm stunned they pushed it back again. So this is a project. It's supposed to be a sort of new age mall. It's going to be this giant mall thing with like amusement parks and ski slopes and all sorts of stuff inside it. And the idea was that people are going to actually leave New York because they've become bored there with the few things to do in that city, and go out to New Jersey and shop at this giant mega mall in the Meadowlands. And New Jersey has been trying to get this thing off the ground for literally years. They started it basically just as the financial crisis hit.
Hold on. Wait a second. I just got to ask, will there be a TGIF there? Because if that's it, that's going to seal the deal for me.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe you have to go pitch them on that.
There we go. So this starts...
And it's just gone through various iterations, and it just keeps getting pushed back and back and back. And it's one of those things that I write about in the book wherein cities and states get themselves in trouble on these sorts of projects, and instead of saying, well, maybe this is a bad idea, they just keep doubling and tripling and quadrupling down on them.
So, all right. So, and at one point it was called Xanadu. I think that's the way it launched as Xanadu. But if I remember correctly, Chris Christie, who was governor at the time, threw a ton of cash at this thing while simultaneously saying, we're not going to build the other tunnel. They wanted to build another tunnel between New Jersey and New York. They were getting a ton of federal funds to do it. And he was like, the state can't afford it. Of course, the idea of the one tunnel going underneath the Hudson River, shutting down for any period of time would be catastrophic for like the economy of New Jersey and, frankly, in many respects of New York and for people's daily lives. But yet they sunk money into this. Like, what is that dynamic?
Yeah, so Chris Christie really loved him some corporate tax breaks. He gave out more than any previous New Jersey governor, at something to the tune of $4 billion. And not just to the American Dream Mall. Sorry, what was the question? I've totally lost my train of thought.
Well, I mean, the whole idea was, I mean, just like what the dynamic there, like what was it supposed to do? What you give that kind of money to the mall, what is it supposed to do?
The idea is that this will be an economy booster, right? People are going to come and they're going to shop and they're going to have a good time. And that's the theory behind not just malls, but sports stadiums and hockey arenas and bringing the Olympics to your city and all that good stuff. And all of the economic evidence shows that this is totally bonkers and that none of the effects that you say are going to happen actually happen. And New Jersey is actually a really good, instructive place to look at because the new governor, Governor Phil Murphy, initiated a review of all the corporate tax incentive programs that were going on in New Jersey and found that there was literally zero accountability going on. These programs were chugging along for years and years, and no one was going back and checking to see if they were actually effective. When they finally pulled all the numbers up, there was something like 3,000 jobs that were showing up on one ledger and not showing up on another ledger, and no one can figure out what happened. And that's emblematic of these programs all over the country. Cities and states spend tens of billions of dollars annually throwing money at corporations with little to no idea if there's any impact, little to no accountability, and oftentimes just no transparency to the public. Something like half of the cities and counties that do this literally don't list to the recipients of the tax breaks. They just say, hey, we gave $25 million to some folks.
So, all right. So walk us through the taxonomy of what we're talking about here. Are we talking about direct payments? Are we talking about money that was not collected? And how do you measure like the cost of that? I mean, that was one of the arguments about the Amazon thing that we hear from people is like, this is money that we're only collecting based upon the activity that Amazon does. And if they aren't here, we're not going to collect that money. I mean, what's the response to that?
So there's a lot of different ways these things happen. The most popular one is actually just property tax breaks. You say to an Amazon or to a sports team owner, hey, if you put your thing here, you don't have to pay property taxes on the land. But a lot of times they often are just cash grants. Sometimes they're cash grants per job created. Sometimes they're just, hey, here's some money, build a thing. Oftentimes they're infrastructure supporting whatever the thing is in question, which is a big problem with Amazon, you know, the helipad and all the stuff that they were going to build up there. So this money comes in a variety of forms. But my main point of contention, I guess, is that there's a huge opportunity cost here, right? Cities and states have to balance their budgets. They're not the federal government. They can't print money. Most of them are constitutionally obligated to balance their budgets. And so every dollar you spend on one of these things is a dollar that you can't spend on the stuff that actually matters to people, on your education system, on your infrastructure, on delivering clean water, the sorts of things that cities and states are supposed to do.
So, all right, but where, I mean, walk me through this dynamic. All right, let's take the film business, because I've always, like, you know, I've looked at, you know, there's two sites there. Well, I mean, you can tell us about the types of subsidies that the film business gets. But if I'm in Michigan, right, and for instance, and or Louisiana or wherever it is, these happen all around the country. There's no film business here. I'm the governor, and I say, well, we're gonna give you these guys a tax break if they come here. I mean, what happens with the film people? And then we'll talk about the results.
Totally. So there are two big dynamics to talk about here. One is you're paying companies to do things they would have done anyway, and that's what happened in the case of Amazon, right? There are really good reasons for Amazon to be in D.C. and New York, and you don't have to pay them to do that. But on the flip side of that coin is something like film and TV tax credits, wherein you say, hey, we don't have a film industry. Let's pay some money to producers to put their productions here, and we'll create one. The problem with that latter plan is that particularly the movie business, but lots of industries, are so transient, and so they will just chase the money. And so you end up paying higher and higher amounts just to keep whatever you have. Louisiana was the first state to do this in a big way. In about 2002, they went whole hog on movie productions. And for a while, the most feature films made anywhere in the country were made in Louisiana, which is wild if you think about, you know, the advantages that California and New York have. But then other states started piling in after and said, hey, stop filming in Louisiana, come to my state. And now actually most feature film production is in Georgia because they were willing to pay more for it. And because these productions can basically go anywhere and make anywhere look like anywhere else, you don't need to be in New York to have your set look like New York, you end up in this competitive economic purgatory where you're just paying more and more and more, and then literally being held hostage by these productions. I was living in Baltimore when the Maryland legislature paid a ton of money to have House of Cards and Veep filmed in Maryland. And California came along and said, hey, Veep, we'll give you $5 million more than Maryland will. Come film in California. And they were gone. Poof. There's nothing left. And so that's the problem with these film things, is the business is so transient that you can just move it whenever someone comes along willing to pay more money.
But that's not the only problem, right? Because and I remember this dynamic, back when I was in the business, there was I was EPing a show that was supposed to be shot in New York. And they're like, we're going to do it in Vancouver because they're going to give us huge tax breaks and incentives, and that's where, you know, we're going to or maybe Toronto, I guess it was Toronto. But the problem is, I mean, it's one thing if you give them, and it's we're talking about tax breaks, right, or tax credits, like and I want you to talk about how those work. But the bottom line is, you give $5 million to a production. The problem is that it doesn't create what it's supposed to create in terms of, like, activity.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's the second big problem with these things, in addition to being constantly held hostage. And if you think about it, these jobs are going to be, by necessity, right, sort of short-term, and they aren't going to last for years on end. The production is going to be there for a little while, and then it's not. And so what oftentimes happens with these programs is that the production comes in and they maybe hire some off-duty police officers to work security, or they hire some hairdressers from the nearby salon to work doing folks' hair, and those get called jobs created, right? But they're not really. They're just jobs shuffled around. So some percentage of the quote created jobs will just wind up being that. You're just renting positions for a little while. And maybe that off-duty police officer gets a little more cash, and that's nice, but that's not a new job. So that is one of the major problems with this. And then the second major problem is that some percentage of the money you spent is inevitably going to go to out-of-state folks, right? Some of that money is going to subsidize Ben Affleck's salary. Some of that money is going to subsidize flying in producers from Hollywood to work for a few weeks and then leave. And it just doesn't create very much. You can sort of see how that's not building anything long-term and sustainable, even if that money does circulate in the local economy for a short period of time, which I am dubious of, and I don't think it really does, it's just a sugar high, and you're not building the foundation for long-term sustainable growth.
Okay, so why doesn't that, I mean, it makes sense that the nature of a film production could be so flighty, that literally flighty, that it's not going to provide any long-term growth. But what about, you know, like, why doesn't it work with the mall? Is it just that the numbers don't give up, or is it that, like, there's an opportunity? I mean, because here's the dynamic that I think, you know, I want you to tease out here, is that if it is just taxes not collected, how do we know that there would be something else there that would generate taxes?
Yeah, totally. So a couple other problems that we haven't talked about. One is when you end up paying a corporation to do things, some of the money ends up inevitably leaking out of the local community, right? So in the case of an Amazon, some percentage of the money they collect is going to leave the community and go back to Seattle or go to Jeff Bezos' tax haven or whatever, right? So some of that money is going to go out. But the other factor to get at here is that there are things you can do that build long-term sustainable growth for everyone that will get you that revenue in the end, right? The problem with so many of these deals, I actually had a guy from Memphis write to me the other day to complain about his city's penchant for doing these deals. And what he said to me, and it was really striking, was what these deals say to me is that our leaders think we have no value as a community. And there's really something to that, right? What you're essentially saying, what your lawmakers are essentially saying when they engage in these deals is there's literally no reason a corporation would ever want to be here unless we pay them a bribe. And it really, the dynamic should be flipped. You should be doing the sorts of things, building up your education system, building up your infrastructure, having the highest quality of life possible, whether that's through childcare or paid leave or whatever the case may be, and saying, no, it's a privilege for your business to be here. We're not going to go begging for scraps. And those are the sorts of things that will, over the long run, entice businesses in and get you that money and create the sort of widespread growth that's for everyone, not just for, like, some tech bros to come in and work their $125,000 jobs, which is great for them, but doesn't really help everybody in the long term. And again, you're not building anything sustainable. You're just building some stuff until the next guy comes along and yoinks it with a higher tax subsidy.
But what do you say about the fictional Memphis, right, that doesn't have the cash? And, you know, so Amazon's going to come in. We're going to say you don't have to pay any property taxes. We're going to expend, you know, some amount of money to build better roads around there so that, you know, your executives will be able to drive and not have a bumpy road. And, you know, you guys will be able to flush your toilets in the building that you build and all at the same time, and it won't explode, that type of thing. And I'm a politician now, and I'm selling it to you as a constituent. And what's going to happen is not only are they going to hire people, but they're going to create, they're going to give money to workers, and workers are going to go out and buy more stuff. And then there are going to be other businesses that will come and we'll charge them taxes. What's wrong with that scenario?
Yeah, the problem is that just doesn't happen in the real world. Every academic researcher who has looked at this has found that that's just not what occurs. The money doesn't circulate that way. Those taxes never wind up coming in. That's a real problem with these things, is that story you just told, that sounds right, right? Like, that in your gut feels correct. And then you have, like, you know, pointy-headed econ wonks coming along and being like, oh, well, no, actually, there are all these ancillary effects you need to womp, 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 take into account, and we sound ridiculous. So that is the difficulty of trying to argue against these things, is saying, hey, everyone who's gone and looked at these deals over and over again, cities and states across the country, that effect just simply doesn't happen. You don't end up getting that money. You don't end up attracting new businesses. You just end up shuffling workers around from job to job and not really creating anything new. But it's a really hard narrative to fight back against, and we've been told for, you know, decades from Democrats, Republicans, everyone in between, that this is the way to build an economy. So we're really fighting against this myth that's been built that the way to create growth and prosperity is to rain money down on big corporations, and then they're going to be really nice and hire some folks. And it just doesn't work that way.
And there's another reason that you write that this myth is so durable, is that it actually, it gets you votes if you're a politician.
Yeah, this is the most surprising thing that came up in my research for the book, is that these things work as a political incentive. Lawmakers who engage in more attempts to work out corporate tax deals get a higher share of the vote. One researcher looked at elected mayors versus unelected mayors at the city level, expecting that unelected mayors would be a little more profligate with these sort of things because they're less accountable. And it actually wasn't the case. It was the elected mayors who did more of these deals than the unelected mayors who towed the line and said no. That does make a certain amount of sense if you think about it, because there are political things worth having that come out of these deals, right? You get to send out the press release saying, hey, Amazon's coming here and it's going to create all these jobs. You get to have your photo taken and put on the front page of the local Times Gazette, whatever. You get to go out and shake hands with Jeff Bezos. In the case of movies, you get to go out and, you know, parade Ben Affleck or Kevin Spacey pre-scandal around town, which is exactly what has happened with House of Cards in Maryland. And so those things are really worth something in political capital, and then you can punt the long-term costs down the road to the next guy.
I mean, that's basically the story of Foxconn, isn't it? And Scott Walker.
Absolutely.
That was 100%. All basically, this is how I'm going to run for president. This is going to be the part that makes me look like a job creator.
Yeah, and actually that was an interesting example because the flip happened, right? He did this thing, and people actually looked pretty closely at it, not just because of Walker, but because Trump got involved and said, hey, this deal actually looks really shady and it's not great. And then when Foxconn itself came out and said, oh, hey, we're not actually going to create all those jobs, you know, things really did fall apart for Walker. And I think you'd argue the same thing with Amazon, wherein it was so high profile that it got a lot of political attention, and therefore, at least in New York, the deal got scuttled. That's really atypical. That doesn't happen with most of these deals. Most of the time, if anyone finds out about them at all, it's years later. I would compare the Amazon case to what Google has been doing, which is just going around the country hoovering up tax breaks using shell companies, not really admitting that it's Google that's behind all this, and no one pays attention to that. And that sort of stuff happens every day, all the time. I am mildly encouraged, actually, that Trump keeps sticking his nose into the middle of these things. It's not just Foxconn, it's Carrier. Because he is bringing scrutiny just because of who he is and because he has this, like, deal-maker-in-chief shtick and the deals keep falling apart, he's bringing a level of scrutiny to these things that really didn't exist before. When I started writing this book in 2016, I was much more discouraged about there ever being a solution to this. I'm actually feeling much better than I have in years about these sort of things.
Amazon really sort of provided all of the elements of your argument on some level, didn't it? I mean, just like including not just from a politician standpoint, but also that question of desperation as they went around. Just, I mean, talk about that dynamic, because there are some places that are just like they will literally do anything to have something different happen.
Absolutely. I think you can't discount the economic context that we are in, right? There are lots of places that, because of bad industrial policy and bad trade deals and bad antitrust policy, letting these giant corporate monoliths get created, really are desperate and really have nothing. And if they're one company towns, they're lucky. They're oftentimes zero company towns. And so even the people, the local officials at that level who do understand what's going on and do get it and, like, realize that this means in 20 years that the playground is going to fall down and the school's roof is going to collapse and they're not going to have any money to deal with it, say, you know what, but right now if we give a bunch of money to, say, Bass Pro Shop to come here and create 30 jobs, that's 30 more jobs than we had yesterday, and we'll figure out the rest later. So there is that element of desperation in a lot of these deals, even amongst the people who acknowledge this is bad and it's going to cost us in the long run, but, like, darn it, we need something today.
What about, like, a place like Detroit? Like, you know, like, I mean, and Amazon, I mean, now, I think the proof is in the pudding to a certain extent. Amazon had no interest as a company, and I think, you know, people will attest to this in Seattle. They don't want to be the company that's responsible for building a community or for supporting a community. And I think, you know, going into Queens, they can hide in terms of, like, their citizen responsibility to the community, and of course they would argue they don't have one because it's a completely a fiduciary one. But what about, like, if you're Detroit? Like, could something like that work for Detroit, where it's just like, come in, we'll give you land? I mean, Detroit seems to me like maybe a special case. I mean, would it be problematic there?
You know, they just tried it, and it was a sports thing, so it wasn't like an Amazon thing. They just tried it with the Detroit Red Wings Arena, which was supposed to turn into this whole downtown business district. Mike Ilitch, I believe his name is, he's the owner of the Red Wings, got this deal in motion a long time ago, and it just hasn't worked. I think it goes back to the problems we were talking about before. When you end up sort of laundering public money through corporations and expecting them to be nice and create all this stuff, the dynamics just don't work the way that our sort of gut tells us that they will. I wouldn't say never for a place like that that really needs something, anything, but oftentimes those deals end up as the worst because the corporation realizes it sort of has the, you know, it has the city over the barrel and can get the best possible terms. And that's the problem with these deals writ large, right? There's always going to be a race to the bottom as long as they exist. And there's always going to be someone who's willing to give a little more. And so that's why even a place that's super desperate winds up giving away the store or the farm or whatever your, you know, analogy of the moment is. I guess it's possible, but the history of these things has been that it just hasn't, even if you're talking about really economically distressed areas, they just end up giving away whatever little is left of their tax base and then not seeing the benefits.
So what is the solution? Is it just simply a changing or introducing people to the reality as opposed to the narrative? I mean, we see this still with sports arenas. You know, and I got to admit, like, you know, there was the Pawtucket Red Sox are coming to Worcester and they're going to become the Woe Sox or the Woo Sox or something like that. And, you know, I mean, I don't live in Worcester anymore. I have family there and but I'm excited. And then I'm like, oh, Worcester is giving them, I don't know, $20 million or something like that. And that just seems ridiculous to me. But I'm torn. Because I'm a, you know, I'm a Red Sox fan, but what is the solution to this? Is it just simply raising the awareness of citizens, or is there actually some type of policy solution?
Yeah, I'll get back to the solutions in a second, but I definitely feel you on that dynamic because here in D.C. where I live, we paid $150 million to build D.C. United Stadium, which is our Major League Soccer team. And I'm a huge soccer fan, and the new stadium is beautiful, and I really like going. But you sort of have to try and disconnect that, right, from the wider policy. It's like, this is really good for me. But I really wish we could have put that into the metro or the healthcare system or any of other D.C.'s many problems. We're actually having a fight here over the one public skating rink in the city, and they can't find the money to fix that up, yet they managed to find the money to build a stadium for not just DC United, but also for the Washington Nationals. So I feel you, and sports is the really hard one because these teams are supposed to be right part of the fabric of the community and, you know, a civic institution, and sports owners do leave if they don't get their stadiums built. So it can be really hard. You never want to be the mayor who loses, you know, the Baltimore Colts or who loses the Seattle Supersonics or whatever the case may be. So those are tough ones. You know, you love your sports team and your sports team doesn't love you back, and you just got to remember that. As to the big solutions, so in theory, Congress could knock this all off tomorrow if it wanted to. If Congress passed a one-page bill that said, henceforth, all state and local corporate tax incentives are hereby taxed at 125%. Boom, done, forget it, it's over. You know, now cities and states are going to have to compete on something else. I am not super optimistic that is going to happen. So honestly, I do think the best remedy is awareness, and it's like a sort of sad, unsexy answer. But just letting people know that this happens. And the reason I wrote the book as I did, and focusing it mostly on entertainment titans, was because I really wanted to drive home that this is your favorite sports team. This is the TV show you watch at night when you're on Netflix. This is the mall you shop in. You know, this is the hotel your mom stays in when she comes to visit. This is the stuff that's in your community all the time, and it's your elected officials who are giving it away. And yeah, that's just a pretty unsatisfying answer, but the Amazon thing has given me a little hope. Boston saying no to the Olympics in 2020 gave me a little bit of hope. The way that things happened with Foxconn gave me a little bit of hope. So, you know, you just got to fight these deals one deal at a time, unless and until Congress comes in and Godzilla stomps the whole thing.
Pat Garofalo, the book is The Billionaire Boondoggle, How Our Politicians Let Corporations and Bigwigs Steal Our Money and Jobs. We'll put a link at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. Anytime.
All right. All right, folks. Head into the fun half. Just a reminder, you can support this program and join us in the fun half by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. For just pennies a day. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Today is Tuesday. Michael's not here, but I'm sure he'll show up for a show. And Matt Taibbi will be here today.
He'll be on. We're gonna pre-record the interview with him, and then Ben Burgess also on.
There you go. Jamie, the Intifada.
Yeah. So out tomorrow, we have an episode breaking down what's going on with Brexit. I think a lot of people in the U.S. probably don't understand it that well, and I learned a lot actually from talking about the Brexit with Sean and our guest Neryl. And also we recorded a bonus wherein we talked to some of our patrons over the phone, and that was really cool and really special. And we just hit our goal of 666 patrons. So yeah, you're gonna do a sound effect?
Oh, sorry.
You looked like you were going for the button. Yeah, so I feel very special and very happy that we have been able to do this for about a year now.
That's
so
great.
Thank you to everyone. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Matt, for helping us get set up. It's been
our pleasure.
Good.
Matt?
Literary Hangover just recorded a barn burner of an episode last night with Alex, my regular co-host, and David Griscom of The Michael Brooks Show. On The Soul of Man Under Socialism by Oscar Wilde, which it's going to be a long one, but look forward to that. So check out Literary Hangover, get caught up before that comes up.
Yeah, you better, folks, because that's a barn burner.
Yep.
Big socialist, Oscar Wilde.
All right. He's actually more of a socialist. He's an anarchist, is what he said.
Oh, hey.
So you'd actually appreciate that.
Cool. But
although he's less utopian than...
That's why he's always burning down the barns.
Well, he says he's an anarchist, but the dynamite policy is absurd. So... Mm.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
C'est une poupée qui fait non, 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 non. Personne ne lui a jamais appris.